This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lena Dunham, is nominated for Independent Spirit Awards in the categories Best First Feature and Best First Screenplay for her new film, Tiny Furniture. And she just finished shooting a pilot for HBO produced by Judd Apatow. The 24-year-old writer and director stars in her new movie. When Tiny Furniture begins, Dunham's character, Aura, has just graduated college in Ohio and returned back home to live with her mother, an artist, and her younger sister, who's still in high school. Dunham's mother is an artist, and she plays the mother. Dunham's younger sister plays the younger sister. The movie was shot in their real home, a beautiful loft in a hip Manhattan neighborhood. Aura is going through a difficult transition. She's awkward and lacking in self-confidence. She and her boyfriend from college just broke up. She's no longer a student, but she's not yet independent, and she's still having trouble fitting back in at home. While her mother and sister are gone for a few days, Aura invites a guy from out of town to stay at her mother's loft. He sleeps in her mother's bed. In this scene, her mother returns home and senses something's gone on in her absence.
Hi, Mommy.
Hey.
I'm so glad you're home.
I've been trying to get in touch with you. I left you lots of voicemails and stuff.
My phone's off. What's up?
What's up is I went to pour myself a glass of wine. Really tired, want to lie down on my bed. 10 bottles of wine are gone. One left.
Okay, I don't really know what to...
And who slept in my bed? Somebody slept in my bed.
I slept in your bed. My mattress is uncomfortable, so I slept in your bed.
Candace told me she saw some guy walking around the loft at around 11 a.m. after you went to work. Way after.
What was Candace doing walking around the loft? Candace should stay in the studio. Candace is a b-.
Candace is a b-.
Yeah,
Candace works for me. Candace comes up here to do things. Candace is up and down, up and down.
Okay, well, it makes me uncomfortable, the idea of Candace walking around my space.
Candace said the place reeked of pot.
That was not my fault. There's no way that was my fault. You know that there's a kid across the air shaft who smokes a ton of weed and will never wave at Nadine.
Okay, but you didn't drink the wine. Who drank the wine? This is Charlotte. I think Charlotte is such an incredibly bad influence.
That's so untrue.
She's unsupervised, out of control.
That's not true. She's with her dad all the time. He takes her to openings all the time.
Bob would go to the opening of a envelope. And I'm sure he wishes people think that Charlotte's his date. He is so skeevy.
You are being very cruel.
No.
Charlotte is my best friend.
For 2 weeks.
Yeah,
the last 2 weeks.
For my whole life, Charlotte's been my best friend. And she's also the only person who seems to care that I'm home. All you seem to care about is the wine. And if you care so much, I'll buy you new wine.
With what money?
I have a job. Did you not hear me last week when I told you that I have a job?
I heard you.
I just got out of school. This is a very hard time for me. If you didn't notice, I had my heart broken, okay? And I'm a young, young person who is trying very hard. And I don't know if you know what it's like to have a job. Did you ever have a job that wasn't just taking pictures of stupid, tiny crap?
No.
Yeah, exactly!
That's a scene from Tiny Furniture. And the director, writer, and star, Lena Dunham, is my guest. Lena Dunham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Writers are usually in a dangerous position, whether it's a novel, memoir, or movie. People you know and love, and people you don't necessarily get along with, are going to imagine that characters are based on them.
Yeah.
And anything unflattering about the character, they're going to think is the way you see them, and they're going to be angry with you. Now, you've actually created, you know, unflattering or at least partially unflattering portrayals of characters that are being played by your family members. So did your mother or sister ever come up to you and say, is this how you see me? Is this what you think of me?
Well, you know, that was a fear of mine. But the ways that I kind of comforted myself with that were before I even showed them the script was like, in my work, no one ever really gets it worse than me. And I was like, so it's like I'm asking you to do this thing, but it's not like I'm asking you to do this thing while I sort of stay out clean. It's sort of like we'll all go down together. And it's also, we talk so much in my house. I mean, really, my house is just such a ridiculous, like, you know, cacophony of different people who have been through a lot of therapy that it's sort of like there's not that much that we can say to each other in this form that we haven't said to each other around the kitchen table. Like, it's such an open dialogue in that way that my mom knows pretty well how I see her. I mean, I always want to say over and over again how impressed I was with how game my mom and sister were to kind of skewer themselves, but also how much they really played characters, because I could spend 2 hours telling you the differences between who my mom is as a mother and who this character of Siri is as a mother, and like, you know, choices that I made for dramatic reasons, for cinematic reasons, that really diverge from our own lives.
Now, your father is not in the film.
He's not, no.
Because?
But my parents are together and married, and I'm really, really close with my dad. There's a few reasons. I mean, the first reason, the kind of like basic logistical reason, is that there was no way I was ever going to get him to do it. He's a really private person in a way. I would say my family's breaking down like this. I'm ridiculous in my oversharing. My mom and sister are very open, but a little more judicious than me about the information that they choose to share with other people about themselves. And my father is like a decidedly private person. Like, he literally has a nickname that only his friends and family know, and then like a, you know, a world name. Like, he's divided his life in that way, and he makes really kind of complex body artwork and is very careful about sort of not having a complex body persona to go along with it. And I knew that there was just no universe in which this was the kind of project he wanted to be involved with.
By complex body artwork, do you mean in part that there's a lot of nudity and phalluses and
there is. There's like, it's really, it's like funny because it's really playful and colorful and sort of seems almost like it comes more from like a cartoony tradition than it does a modern art tradition. But then it's really sexually aggressive. It's really explicit. It's really, I mean, he's depicting scenes that are like not, you know, not savory. But it's really funny because then people meet him and he's this, you know, very polite, thoughtful guy in a suit, and it's just not what you it's like sort of like one of these things is not like the other one. You don't quite understand the person you're seeing and the work that you're seeing as being connected.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lena Dunham. She wrote, directed, and stars in the new independent film Tiny Furniture. I want to play one more scene from Tiny Furniture, and this is a scene with a guy that you've met who is on his way, he thinks, to becoming like a comic and maybe having a series. In the meantime, he's been doing the short things on YouTube. You seem to think you're having a relationship with him, and he seems to think that you're not. So
yes.
He's been crashing in somebody's apartment and very uncomfortable there. Your mother's gone and your sister are gone. They're looking at colleges. So you've got this beautiful Tribeca loft to yourself. So you invite him to stay at your place. And he's been sleeping on this air mattress, which he finds very uncomfortable. And you'd be happy to be sleeping with him. So you take this as an opportunity to basically invite him into your bed. So here's the scene.
You okay down there?
I think the mattress is deflating.
No way.
It is. It's defective. It's devastating.
So you're just sinking?
I'm sinking. Slowly. It's a mathematical certainty.
I don't have anything else for you to sleep on, so maybe you should just get in my bed. Sorry. Jesus.
Girls sweat up the bed.
I don't sweat up the bed.
Has anyone ever told you that you sweat up a bed?
No one's ever said that.
Never, ever?
Never, ever.
Okay.
Of course, your mother, I just told you that you sweat up the bed. So it's a very kind of like low self-esteem kind of scene.
It is, yeah. I listen to it. I'm like, especially if you're not seeing it going on, you're like, well, that's pretty depressing. Why is she letting him talk to her that way?
Yeah, so why is she?
Well, I mean, it's a dynamic I've experienced and also a dynamic I've witnessed in a lot of my friends, which is, I think, you know, it's trite to say, but when you're not sure about who you are and when you're not sure about what you're worth or what your purpose is, there's a way that you'll let people who you think have a clearer sense of those things, you'll sort of be thankful for any attention that those people will give you. And it's a mindset that I think is universal but pretty prevalent in a girl of a certain age, you know, in a girl between in her early to mid 20s, just because there's a way that you're so desperately looking for somebody to sort of define you, and that's something that you can kind of seek out in male companions. And I've, you know, been the victim of or the perpetrator of, depending on how you look at it, a lot of kind of ambiguous platonic friendships in my day. And that was definitely a dynamic that I was looking to explore, and so, sort of the darker underbelly of that.
There's a scene, without getting too much into plot detail, because I don't want to give too much away, where your character has humiliating and cold sex with somebody.
Yeah.
And I should say it's unprotected sex. So she says, you don't have HIV, do you?
Which is obviously the best way. Everyone listening, the best way to figure out if someone has an STD is to ask them.
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I guess I was wondering, why would your character not insist on some kind of protection from this person who she really doesn't know very well?
Well, I've thought about that a lot too, and I think one answer is being afraid that somehow that person, if you even take a moment to, like, say, will you use a condom, they'll be reminded of what they're doing and decide they don't actually really want to have sex with you. Because at that moment, I think she thinks he's doing her a big favor. She feels like he's more attractive than she is and more accomplished than she is, and she should take what she should get, what she can get. But I also think that there's a lust factor, which sort of people haven't really thought about when they've looked at that scene, which is that, like, she's also attracted to him and wants to have sex with him and is taken up in the moment in the same way that a guy might be. And I think that is sort of an angle that, like, she doesn't know that much about sex, but she's very interested in it.
But the first thing you said is basically asking for protection is also asking to be rejected, because it just brings you one step closer to being rejected from somebody who probably doesn't care that much about you in the first place.
It's almost like, well, if we have to use a condom, that's a whole ordeal. So maybe we should just, like, go get some ice cream instead. Like, that feeling that she knows that having sex with her isn't like that high on his list of must-do activities. It's sort of something he's doing because she's made it so available to him. And that's not a way that I live my life, but it's a dynamic that I've seen and understand.
Now, one more self-esteem question. Your character in Tiny Furniture has a YouTube video that was very popular when she was in college. Why don't you describe the video?
The video that she has, which is in fact a video that I made when I was in college, is the character whose name is Aura, or me, whose name is Lena, because I'm sort of using some material from my own, for a change, using some material from my own life. She's wearing a bathing suit and bathing herself in an on-campus fountain at her college. And she kind of goes through all the motions of bathing and then is interrupted by a security guard who asks her to remove herself from the fountain. And her body is sort of like a doughy college, a doughy eating pizza at 2 a.m. kind of college body. And so there's something a little jarring, I think, about sort of seeing her in that bikini in that place.
And what was your intention when you made the video?
You know, I don't think I was – that was not one of my most thoughtful pieces of work. It definitely was – I as far as I could consider it, I'd taken a gender and women's studies class and was also interested in, Jackass. So it's sort of like where those two things meet. And I made it and I put it on the internet. This is all true. And then one day I'd made a web series that somebody at YouTube had liked and had made a front page sort of like a spotlighted video. And then somebody made that video a spotlight video on YouTube. And suddenly overnight, I was on vacation with my family in Sweden. I opened my email inbox, and I was used to getting like one YouTube comment every 2 months. And I had like 5,000 emails, and I looked and the movie had 1.5 million hits. The video had 1.5 million hits on YouTube, and just pages of commentary basically debating the merits or dismerits of my physical form. And I pulled the video from the internet, not because I was so upset by the fat debate, but because I kind of just didn't want – I was like, I don't think this is my best work, and I don't want it to be the thing that people find when they go and look for me, if they do.
Like, how connected is your self-esteem to your body image, to your body weight, to what people think of you physically? How connected was it to the kinds of insulting comments about you, being a little pudgy that you got from the YouTube video?
Well, it's funny because, my joke I always make about myself is that I'm self-involved, but I'm not vain. I don't know. That's what I always say to my mom. It's like, I've just never never been overly concerned with those things. I'm like always having to be told to brush my hair. I'm always having to be, and I love clothes. Like I love fashion. I have a totally bad shopping habit, but it's much more because I like things that are fun and fun to touch and colorful and amuse people rather than an idea about trying to look sexy. But that being said, you know, I'm a woman, I'm a young woman living in an age where this is the upset, like the national obsession. I can't lie about that. And so, you know, it's funny, like I recently, just from growing up and stopping certain collagey eating habits, lost like 15 pounds. And it's, and you know, I'm still bigger than any other girl you're going to see in a movie or on TV. But it's, it was interesting because I think people reacted to it sort of like, oh, well, you're going Hollywood. And that was so, it was sort of just like, I'm still young, like my body's still growing and changing. Like I don't even know what height I am yet. Like it was sort of, and I would say my feelings, I would say my self-worth is mostly connected to my feelings of usefulness surrounding my work, and that, but that, you know, I'm a heterosexual woman who wants to feel attractive. So I have to reconcile those things every day.
Now, as we mentioned, your mother plays your mother in the movie. And early in the film, you're looking for a light bulb. And in the cabinet where the light bulb is also your mother's diary from when she was your age. And you read it, and she doesn't object to you having read it. And I think it's your actual mother's real diary that you use in this. And the parts that you're reading, a lot of it have to do with how much she wanted to be an artist. And she says in the diary, the most security she could have, the thing that would make her most secure, is a good portfolio of her artwork. Yeah. Did you relate to that?
Fully. And finding those diaries of my mother's was a real watershed moment for me because, you know, I've always known her my entire life. She's been someone who's sort of been doing the impossible, which is supporting herself and a family in a career, doing what she wants to do, sort of having that holy grail of having a job that's also sort of some kind of catharsis and self-expression. I guess that's not what everyone wants from a job, but that was always my hope, maybe because I was raised around it. And so it was when she would say to me, sort of described to me her struggles to find herself. It almost felt like a lie. Like it was just so hard for me to imagine. And every picture I saw of her from when she was my age looked, you know, it just looked like a bunch of like beautiful people hanging around a loft in the 70s. And I was sort of like, what problems did you ever have? Like, I mean, it was, and I read the diaries and it was just incredible. They were, you know, portrait of the artist as a young man, kind of just amazing, amazing insight. And it was very comforting to me.
Were there generational differences that you saw between what she experienced as a young woman in the 70s and what you were experiencing, you know, recently?
I think a really fascinating thing to me was the lack of social networking, because the fact that she would say, you know, like, and, you know, random boyfriend X didn't call me today, I'm going to have to walk to 14th Street and knock on his door. And, you know, there was no way to sort of like poke someone on the Facebook or send them a text message. Or she's like, you know, I'm supposed to see my best friend Jane this afternoon, so I guess I'll swing by where she works and see if she's on this afternoon. That kind of real engagement with other people, it was so kind of crazy for me to realize how much of my life is sort of mediated by these technologies that weren't even a twinkle in her eye.
There's a scene in the movie that I found so just hard to imagine. And I'm not saying because there's anything wrong with it. It was just like so outside of my realm of experience.
Yeah.
And the scene I'm thinking of is when you climb into your mother's bed because you just need some warmth and consolation. And I found that unimaginable.
That's so interesting. Well, it's I've talked to certain people who are like, you know, I get in bed with my mom every chance I get, and certain people are like, I've never gotten in my parents' bed once as long as I can remember. And
yeah.
I think that was always a thing in my house, was if my dad was going away, we'd always go, oh my God, well, can we sleep in your bed? My sister and I would fight about who could sleep in my mom's bed and if there was enough room for the two of us. And I haven't slept in bed with my mom now in maybe a year, but that's still a lot. I'm like I'm way over that. I haven't done it in a year, but that still means I was doing it till I was 23. So
and why? What did you need from that?
I mean, to me it was sort of this, I think I was really scared to sleep as a little kid. I had a terrible, terrible phobia, like to, you know, it was like a pretty full-time job for my parents to get me into bed. Once I was asleep, I was fine, but just the process of getting me into bed, and I'd always say, you have to tell me something that I have to look forward to tomorrow, please, because I think, honestly, that it was a little kid version of being totally afraid to die. And I think, so for me, sleeping in bed with my mom was, because I don't do it anymore, it was sort of a way to sort of, like, squash the kind of, like, loneliness and anxiety that comes up when you're lying in bed and all you have to do is think. And she was, she was receptive to it. And it's funny because it's even though my mom had a different kind of relationship with her parents, I just found her asleep in bed with her mom like 2 weeks ago.
Really?
I did. It was like the sweetest thing I've ever seen.
Your movie's kind of a coming-of-age movie. It's the coming-of-age of the person who's just graduated from college and is trying to figure out what's next.
Yeah.
There's a whole genre of coming-of-age movies, usually told from a male point of view, often nowadays very obsessed with sex, like, how do I get to have sex? How do I get to have sex with, like, an attractive girl? I'm going to end up drinking a lot and taking a lot of drugs in the process and mistreating people. And so I wonder how you relate to that kind of male point of view, coming of age comedy with a lot of excess beer and drugs.
Yeah.
And
there's so many of those movies. I mean, the American Pie movies, it was a whole franchise of that. Superbad, which I think is the best version of that, because I think that movie's really smart and thoughtful and loving, although I'm sure people could level lots of sort of complaints at the behavior it depicts, but I think it's a just really smart, well-made movie. And those movies are often about, like Superbad, they're trying to lose their virginity to hot ladies, as they are in American Pie. But it's, and I could say, oh, that's a character goal that doesn't make sense to me, except in Tiny Furniture, my character is just like desperately trying to have sex with a brainless, attractive man. That's her goal too. So it's funny because it's that, it's not like I'm necessarily doing something different. It's just that I'm a woman, so it is different. But it's funny, I'm working on a project with Judd Apatow, and people have asked me a lot. They've said, oh, this feels like an unlikely pairing, you working with Judd, because of the fact that his movies are sort of notoriously, from a male perspective, of sort of about schlubby men pursuing attractive women. And it's funny because that's actually a story that makes a lot of sense to me. And that's sort of a story that my movie's in some way a warped version of.
Cast as the schlubby man?
With me cast as the schlubby man. Like, I once made a joke before I ever was ever working with Judd. I made a joke that I wanted to make a reverse Apatow movie where sort of like James Franco falls in love with a fat girl stoner and like has to teach her the meaning of like love and adult responsibility. Sort of like if like Knocked Up got switched around, only the cool conceit of Knocked Up is that she's pregnant, so she has to give him a chance. Whereas I don't know how you would do it the other way around, because I can't get James Franco pregnant. But the thing is that there's a way that that Tiny Furniture is that narrative a little bit of this like girl who doesn't know herself, doesn't know her own body. And I think one of the male characters in Tiny Furniture, I find them both attractive, really attractive, and one of them's a really like kind of conventionally attractive, kind of like male sex object who's not ultimately very good for her, but who she pursues blindly anyway.
Now, your new movie is called Tiny Furniture because the mother in the movie makes her photographs with tiny furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the movie could very well have been called Tiny Camera, because from what I've read, you used a really tiny camera to shoot this.
We did. We used a camera called the Canon 7D, which is it's a digital still camera, but that has a video function. So Jody Lee Lipes is my DP, and he's a writer and director in his own right, and just I was a big fan of his before I ever got to work with him. And he shoots mostly on film, but he knew that we didn't have the budget for it, and so kind of had the idea to use this camera that was, and so it was a bit of an experimental thing to do. Our editor, Lance Edmonds, owned the camera. So we shot, and there was something really wonderful about it, because I think I didn't think about this till later, but working with non-actors, they weren't afraid of this little camera. It looked like something they knew and had seen and understood.
Like a step away from using your cell phone to to take pictures.
Exactly.
Of people.
It was a little bit like holding up your iPhone and being like, we're making a movie. Like, you're almost tricking people into feeling comfortable with this little thing.
So that means that your scenes had to be really short, because the camera would only shoot really short scenes.
You know, it was actually the camera can record up to 40 minutes of video footage. So so it is, the scenes didn't have to be short, but there were limitations. Like, for example, the camera doesn't do that well with movement. So, like, it wasn't like we were doing a lot of panning or a lot of following characters. We really kind of had to pick a place for the camera to sit and then just allow the scene to unfold in front of it. And ultimately, it made the film feel very photographic in a way that almost mimicked my mom's work in a way, which was something I sort of was going for maybe subconsciously and didn't realize until later that we had sort of achieved that.
All right. So you're at like a new threshold in your life. You don't know whether your HBO pilot is going to be accepted or not. You don't know if your new movie, Tiny Furniture, is going to be a hit or not. So just an approximate level of anxiety and stress right now?
You know, surprisingly low. That's very, I always like being asked. I'm always like, thank you for asking. Thank you for checking in. Because it's low. I've been so excited by getting to travel with the movie and so excited by getting to do the work that I've sort of buried a lot of those fears in that. And sort of like, I'm so amazed. Like, you know, like today I was like, I get to wake up today and talk to Terry Gross. Like it was this crazy, it was every day brings this sort of crazy, like, is this really happening? Pinch me now moment. But there is also, there's a way that I can't, people, I've gotten a lot of, you know, people's sort of favorite thing to say via emails, like enjoy every moment of it, which was also people's favorite thing to say about high school. So that, but you know, I'm sort of doing this weird thing. It's sort of a little bit like being in a movie and directing the movie at the same time. It's like I'm being in it and enjoying every minute of it, but I'm also because of my parents' careers, because of maybe the way I was raised and also just my general disposition, which is worry-wardish and pretty hyper-analytical, I'm always aware of sort of the ebbs and flows of a creative career. So I'm always sort of like planning for disasters before they even happen. So it's this funny balancing act of really appreciating sort of the magic of it all, which for me is not getting old anytime soon, while also sort of being aware of the challenges of having of this particular job.
Lena Dunham, thanks so much for talking with us and good luck.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Lena Dunham wrote, directed, and stars in the new movie Tiny Furniture. You can watch clips on our website, freshair.npr.org. Walter Mosley's new novel is about a man in the early stages of dementia. Coming up, Mosley tells us about watching his mother transformed by Alzheimer's disease. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest writer, Walter Mosley, is best known for his Private Eye series about the character Easy Rawlins. The novels are set in African-American neighborhoods in L.A. and span the years 1948 to 1967. Mosley wrote his new novel after watching his mother transformed by Alzheimer's disease. The novel is called The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray, and it's about a 91-year-old man who's in the early stages of dementia and has no one to take care of him now that his grandnephew was shot and killed. The rest of his extended family has virtually abandoned him. He's living alone in chaos and filth. He makes a deal with a doctor to try a new experimental drug that will restore his memory for 3 months, but will kill him after that. Ptolemy hopes the drug will restore his memory long enough to investigate who killed his grandnephew. Walter Mosley, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like you to do a short reading from The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray, and I'm going to ask you to introduce it for us.
Well, Ptolemy has been in his house for 3 days, though he believes it's been a week and a half. He hasn't seen his caretaker, Reggie, who's his great-grandnephew, for that time, and he's worried. He's very nervous. He sits in his house listening all day to the radio and the television, and he's a little lost between what was and what is. He's just entering dementia. Reggie's cousin, Hilly Brown, has called Ptolemy and said, "I'm coming over," but Ptolemy's been very confused about it. But finally, he opens the door, and the reading starts from there. Hilly Brown approached. He was quite large, much taller than Ptolemy, and almost as wide as the door. "Can I come in, Papa Gray?" "Do I know you?" "I'm your great-grandnephew," he said again, "June's grandson." Too many names were moving around in Ptolemy's mind. Hilly sounded familiar, and June, too, had a place behind the door that kept many of his memories alive, but mostly unavailable. That's how Ptolemy imagined the disposition of his memories, his thoughts. They were still his, still in the range of his thinking, but they were, many and most of them, locked on the other side of a closed door that he'd lost the key for. So his memory became like secrets held away from his own mind. But these secrets were noisy things. They babbled and muttered behind the door. And so, if he listened closely, he might catch a snatch of something he once knew well. June. June was my niece, he said. Yeah, the boy said, smiling. Can I come in, Uncle?
That's Walter Mosley reading from his new novel, The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. Would you describe the home that Ptolemy Gray is living in and the state of disrepair it has entered because of his dementia?
He's been living in this apartment for maybe 60 years. He's 91 years old. He's been living there since, you know, he turned 30. Everything that's ever come into that house is still there. Old pizza cartons, all clothes, newspapers, every toothbrush he ever owned. It's really like a hoard of a house, but it's also everything. It's his family. It's all of his memories just jumbled up together, piled so high that it almost looks like a storage unit. And he can't throw away anything because he's not sure what's valuable and what isn't. It's not that he wants everything. It's just that he doesn't know how to get rid of things.
Now, he sleeps in a thin mattress under a desk. And describe his bathroom for us.
Well, his bathroom, the toilet is all stopped up. Everything is dirty and has black mold growing over it. There's, you know, trash kind of everywhere. It just doesn't work anymore. And but that's okay for him because, you know, he uses a lard can for number one. And every 3 days when Reggie comes, he takes him to a coffee shop where he can have his bowel movement. He's learned how to live in this very, very limited life. The bedroom has been completely blocked off. He doesn't even go in there. Bathroom is blocked off. The kitchen is mostly a mess. But it's okay for him because he's holding on. He's holding on to his consciousness, partially by listening to the radio and the television all day long.
Now, is his apartment based on an apartment that you've seen?
It's not based on an apartment that I've seen. But, you know, my mother went through dementia for many years, but in the last three or four, it was very, very serious. And that's the way my mother was. She would turn on the television, and she had to keep it on because she could never figure out how to turn it back on. Sometimes she'd turn the television off with the remote control and then try to use the telephone to turn it back on again with the buttons on the phone because she'd gotten confused. She didn't exactly – she knew what she wanted, but she didn't exactly know how to get there.
What was it like for you to try to imagine what was going on in her mind? Because that's certainly what you've tried to do in your new novel, is try to understand what's going on in the mind of your main character who has dementia.
Well, you know, when you deal very closely, you know, with a person who's experiencing, you know, dementia or Alzheimer's or whatever, you can see where they're struggling with knowledge. You can experience that. You can see how what they forget completely, what they forget but they know that they once knew. You can tell how they're trying to remember. There's a scene in here where Ptolemy goes into a bank and he keeps on looking at everybody's face because he wants to know every face. But every time he looks at a face and he goes to another one, he forgets the one that he just saw. So he goes back over and over and over. And I watch my mother do, you know, very similar things. Also, you know, getting angry because people don't understand what you're trying to say, even though it seems very clear to you. And a lot of that understanding is very clear inside their mind, but it's just not being communicated in the correct way.
And what your character does is take an experimental drug. I'll ask you to explain what the drug is.
You know, one of the big issues about the brain and how it works is the electronic connections, how the brain is firing and how what is there is, you know, connected to the ability to think, to manipulate it. I came up with just a notion. Of course, it's a fictional notion that there's doctors, even though I actually believe it must be true somewhere, that there are doctors doing illegal medical research in Mumbai and studying on people with new medicines they're coming up with, trying to increase these electronic connections. They've done it to some degree, only they haven't isolated it to the brain. And so what happens is when they give the medicine to somebody, they very often get their memory back and their ability to think, but if it's early enough in the dementia, but the medicine also kills them because they get these high fevers and their whole body starts to respond to the drug in ways that are, you know, deleterious.
And just for anybody tuning in, that's fiction. That's something Walter Mosley made up for his novel.
Well, yes. But I'm sure there's somebody out there thinking about it, you know, because it's a very delicate thing, you know. Dealing with all the different kinds of drugs and the abilities to deal with people, there's always trouble. People are always saying, well, you can't do this, you can't do that. But, you know, there are people who are, you know, having ideas all the time that are kind of outside the box of the medical institution.
So he decides to take the medicine. Right. His memory is restored, and that opens up all kinds of interesting doors and mysteries solved.
He's given an offer. He's given an offer. The doctor says, look, I can give you this medicine, and there's a chance that for the next 3 months you're going to have perfect memory. There's a chance that you're going to be able to think the way you used to. So at the end of that 3 months, it's definite you're going to be dead. If you don't take the medicine, you got a good body, you might live another 10 years, but you won't know a thing. So you make the choice, 3 months aware or 10 years in a daze. And he says, I'll take the 3 months.
Do you know which decision you'd make?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd take the 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing, you know. And of course, you know, Ptolemy thinks that this doctor, this white doctor with this big mustache, is the devil. And he realizes that his only choice is to deal with the devil. And that is accepting death in a way. But what are you going to do?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Walter Mosley, and he's best known for his E.Z. Rollins mystery series, and his new book is called The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. Your father died about 14 years ago, do I have that right?
16, I think, yeah.
16 years ago, okay. Yeah. And your mother died about 4 or 5 years ago?
My mother died 2 years ago this January.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 2 years this January.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel like a part of you, or at least a part of your memory, a part of your past, died with your parents? Because in some ways, one of the functions that parents serve is that they're the keepers of your past. They're the ones who knew you when you were a baby, who knew you when you were three, who watched you, you know, become a teenager and become a man or woman.
It's even worse in my position. I'm an only child. My mother was an only child. My father was an orphan. And so not only did I lose them, I'm not completely, but I'm almost completely without family. And it's a very odd feeling, you know, in life, you know, because I have no children. And so every once in a while, I'll just be sitting there and I'll say, wow, I'm very much. I met a guy the other day. He told me, he says he has 27 brothers and sisters.
Wow.
And it just struck me. I went, wow, 27 brothers. He doesn't even know all their names, you know. So sometimes he runs into people and I say, I'm your brother. He says, I heard about you. I never met him, but I heard about you. With me, like, there's nobody. And it's an odd feeling. So, yes, losing my parents really kind of set me adrift in more ways than one. It's not just losing them. It's losing the possibility of family.
I mean, the positive side of what you're saying is a sense of, like, you, there's the opportunity for reinvention all the time, in the most positive sense, you know. But there's no anchor to the past. Were there things that really surprised you about your emotional reaction when your mother died and you had no parents anymore?
Well, so odd. You know, when my father died, I gained like 70 pounds. And when my mother died, I lost 100.
Wow.
And I keep on trying to figure that out. I mean, I've tried to lose the 100, but, you know, I thought for a long time I wanted to lose it. But after my mother died, it just came right off. I said, oh, I'm doing this now, and I did it. And so that's a big change. And I think that, you know, that it called on in some ways this odd, awkward midlife crisis that hadn't struck me before, where all of a sudden there was a life that I had to create that I didn't have to create when I still had parents, even if I wasn't communicating with them. There was, as you said, they were holding a life. It was a past thing, a previous thing, but it was my life, and that's what I identified with.
So what did you change in your life after they died?
You know, that's still a very difficult question to answer, to be able to to nail down what that experience is and what a good response to that is, either on the behalf of the person who's experiencing it or the caregiver, somebody trying to take care of them. Because that was a very big thing for me. When my mother was suffering, I would go to bed every night worried. You know, my mother, you know, she had this job for the Board of Education in Los Angeles, and they wouldn't let her go. She couldn't do anything. She couldn't work. She didn't recognize anybody. But, you know, she'd helped so many people in her job that they wouldn't let her go, so she went in. And, you know, I had to hire a car to drive her in and drive her home. It cost more than her paycheck, but she would cash her paycheck, and she had this thick wad of $100 bills. And she would go wandering around the streets to stores with this thick wad of $100 bills. I was so worried about her. But at the same time, you know, I realized I had to allow her to be who she was while slowly trying to convince her, Mom, you need to be in a different way to be safe. And it took a long time. And I was very worried.
Well, to make matters worse, you live on the East Coast in New York and she lived on the West Coast in L.A.,
she would call me up and say, I don't have anything for dinner. And I had to figure out, you know, there, how to get dinner to her. Otherwise, she's going to go wandering the streets looking for food, you know.
So did you do call a deli or something?
It's very funny. A hotel I stay in L.A., I always stay there. I called up the concierge and they said, okay, that's fine. We'll take care of it. We'll get some food and send it over to your mom. Because they knew her and they knew I've been staying there forever. It was really very nice of them. And, you know, then I hired a driver, and then finally I hired the woman who came and stayed with her, Eloise.
You know, we were talking about losing part of your life, part of your past when your parents died. You did a lot of research into your father's life, because a lot of his stories were woven into your Easy Rollins series.
Yeah.
And so I imagine you knew a lot more about your father's life than a lot of people know about their father's lives, because you probably pressed him for information as a writer. Did you know as much about your mother's life as about your father's?
I knew a lot about my mother's life, her history here in New York, going to Hunter College and moving to Los Angeles, being a journalist, marrying a really, really rich man in Los Angeles and deciding that she didn't like him. Leaving and, you know, meeting my father, you know, my mother being a Jewish woman from New York, my father, a black man from Louisiana, and, you know, starting a life back there in 1950.
When I interviewed you in 1994, we were talking about your Easy Rollins series, and I asked you if your father had told you about violence in the segregated South when he was growing up, because that's the kind of stories that you had drawn on.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to play back your answer.
Okay. One day my father sat me down and explained to me, or he told me, every person he'd ever seen die. It was just amazing. Little children killing each other, black children, black people killing white people killing black people killing, you know, everybody killing each other, people being hung, people dying because there was not a proper protection on their jobs. And then he went to World War II. And he talked about all the people that he saw die in World War II because he worked in statistics, so he typed up the names of everybody, all the Americans who had died. And finally he came back to the South after that, and he found that all of his old friends, or most of his old friends who didn't go to war, had died also in, you know, these kind of petty and stupid little fights and arguments and from disease in the South. And so he moved to Los Angeles. And when my father, this took a long time to tell me all of these deaths. And at the end of it he said, so then, Walter, I came to L.A., and I knew I was finally free. I was in a land where these kind of things weren't going to happen anymore. And he sits down in a diner, and the guy next to him has a heart attack, keels over and falls in my father's lap.
Oh, no.
And dies. And it was a good way to end it, because it was a funny story. But also the idea of, you know, there's segregation, there's violence because of racism and from ignorance and poverty, but also we all die. And I think that's what he was trying to tell me.
Okay, so that's Walter Mosley as recorded in 1994. So Walter Mosley, that's such a really great story. Did you grow up expecting to confront the numbers of death that your father did and the kind of violence that your father did?
Oh, no, not at all. My father, one of the things my father did was he made me feel extraordinarily safe. He made me feel that I've taken care of it, nothing's going to happen to you. And I always felt like that. And, you know, things did happen. I mean, I got stopped by police. They would pull guns on me and do all kinds of things. But all through that, I was never really worried because my father said, you're going to be safe. And, you know, I believe my father. And on the whole, it's been true.
Now, in comparing your life to your father's life, is your version of being a man different than your father's?
Yeah, it has to be, and it is necessarily. You know, my father's life was so decimated by his earliest experiences. His mother dies when he's 7 years old, which he always said was the worst experience he ever had in his life. When he was 8, his father disappeared, was probably killed, and he was a logger. And he was on his own from the age of 8. It's necessarily different how we face life and how we are, you know, men in life. I mean, the difference between E.Z. Rawlins and that series of books and my new series of mysteries, the Leonid McGill mysteries, underscores that, what a different world me and my father lived in.
Walter Mosley, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Walter Mosley's new novel is called The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.